What I'd like to do is, and I hope this is interesting, but I'd like to take a look at some background material. And it's background material that is, I think, relevant to the Passover season. It's about something that in some ways was very outrageous. It's the trial of Jesus Christ. And I think it's important for us to consider the trial of Jesus, what he went through, and I kind of alluded to it a little bit in the last sermon I gave, where we talked about Jesus spiritually preparing for the upcoming Passover and the lessons he had to pass on to the disciples and for us. And one of the points that always strikes me, and I don't know if I can really, you know, project what I think and you ever see it the way I see it, but it is how incredibly challenging it would be to have all the power to do whatever you want and put up with some of the stuff that Jesus had to put up with. If you've ever thought about it that way, knowing who he was, knowing that he was the Word, who was with God, who was God, to be treated the way he was. And so we're going to take a narrow subject, and we're just going to look at the trial of Jesus. And in fact, we're not even going to look at the trial that took place before the Roman authorities, because that was just pretty much a rubber stamping of what the Sanhedrin had done. Okay? Now, this trial that I'm talking about is the trial before the Sanhedrin. This is the high priest, this is the elders, this is the chiefs. These are the people who should have known better, because they had full access to the Word of God. They had full access to the Word of God, and they had hundreds and I think 1,000 years of experience. Now, they hadn't always done a good job of it, but they had the scriptures. This trial took place before an official legal body. It wasn't a lynch mob. It was a trial. It was a real trial. It took place in Jerusalem before a body called the Great Sanhedrin. The Great Sanhedrin, okay? And the Great Sanhedrin sort of acted like the Supreme Court of the land, okay? They were a country that was occupied by a foreign country, or foreign empire, Rome. But they were allowed to manage most of the things on their own, and they had their own legal system, and they had their own way of dealing with things. There were just a few things that the Romans kept for themselves, execution and taxation, things that were fairly important to them, and military. All across the land in Israel, or Palestine, as the Romans called it, there were other little Sanhedrins, just like we have in our country, where there are local courts all over the land deciding local matters. Okay, so all these Sanhedrins would be in local areas, and they had to have at least 120 male heads of household. All right, so they had to have a certain critical mass of people there in order for there to be a court, a local court. And this local Sanhedrin would be composed of 23 men, okay? 23 men, and they always chose an odd number so that there would not be a tie. Seems sensible. Their purpose was to judge local cases, and these judgments of the lesser courts could be appealed. You know, we see the same thing in our land, where you can go to court. If you don't like what the local judge says, you can appeal. So the higher court, they'll get your appeal, and they'll decide to accept it or not. And the final court of appeals in the land, in Israel, was this Great Sanhedrin of Jerusalem. The Sanhedrin of Jerusalem also had jurisdiction over the local area as well, stuff that was going on in the city and its close environment. This Great Sanhedrin was composed of 70 members plus a high priest. Makes me think of the Senate, where you've got the two equal bodies, or you've got the Senate, but you also have the deciding vote, which is the vice president. So you always have an odd number. So you've always got someone who's going to be a tiebreaker. So the Great Sanhedrin was composed of 70 members plus the high priest. There were 24 chief priests, including the high priest. There were 24 elders and 23 scribes. This is where you'd get all the Sadducees and the Pharisees and all these people who had kind of worked their way up in, I guess you would call it a political system, the legal system. by virtue of serving on lower courts and by virtue of establishing a good record of wisdom and prudence. I'm sure there were other shenanigans going on in the background, but let's just give him the benefit of the doubt for the time being. This great Sanhedrin sat atop a legal system that was proud of its principles of fairness and equity and justice and respect for life. And that's because it was a system built upon the principles of the Old Testament, revealed knowledge from God. Turn with me to Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy 16, let's read a few scriptures about God's expectation for people in Israel to establish righteous judgment in the land. Deuteronomy 16, verses 18 and 20. God's word is here, says, appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God is giving to you. And they shall judge the people fairly. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of righteousness. Follow justice and justice alone, so that you may live and possess the land of the Lord your God, possess the land the Lord your God is giving you. This was the overarching principle that they had, and they tried their best to follow. I just wanted to let you know that the information that I'm giving you about the structure and all that kind of stuff, you can get a lot of this information in Edersheim's Life and Times of Jesus, for example. Simon Greenleaf also has a very interesting book, The Testimony of the Evangelists, where they talk about what the system was, what the legal environment was. Now, these are books about the entirety of Jesus' life and times, so you'd have to kind of drill down into the chapter to get to this exact information. I found I was going through this, and I found I had notes from back in college in my Bible, and I thought, yeah, this is the same information, and I'd kind of let it drift out of my mind, and it was good for a refresher. So if you've heard this before, hopefully this will be a good refresher for you. If you've not heard it before, it's always good to hear something new, as long as it's true, right? Okay. Again, just saying I'm drawing some of this material from the two reference books that I've mentioned to you. There were some procedural guarantees. There were some procedural guarantees that were in place at the time. So when they had a court system, this is this verse that we read there in Deuteronomy is, it's very general. It talks about the overarching philosophy of justice and fairness and impartiality. But they had to come up with some, boots on the ground ways of ensuring that these things came to pass. So they made up rules and they made up procedures and stuff like that. And I think you'll find it interesting when you compare it to our legal system and you see, oh, that's just like what we do, or that's different from what we do. Okay, so I've got four procedural guarantees. And I'm going to lay out the information first, and then we're going to look at them and how they were applied and actually misapplied during the trial of Jesus Christ. So the accused who came before these courts was guaranteed a certain right or certain rights of procedure. The first one was the right to a public trial. A public trial. Now, I know it's a lot of sidebars, but I want to mention something. We take a lot for granted in our country. And we take for granted that a trial is going to be public. Okay? That's not the case in all places in the world, and it definitely has not been the case throughout history. But a right to a public trial was one of the guarantees that the Jewish legal system had built in. And the purpose, I think it's obvious to most people, should be, the idea is that the public could witness, all right, they could see what was going on, they could keep an eye on what was going on in these courts, they could keep an eye on the officials, they could know what they were talking about and what their judgments were. In fact, there were even to be some impartial auditors in the court, people who were not judges, but who were just there as representatives, citizens, to see that everything was done in a certain way, and they also participated in the case, and I'll mention that a little later. This also meant that the trial was to be conducted in a public place, okay, not some dark dungeon somewhere. And it was to take place during the day, when people were awake, up and about, and around town and about their business. Okay, so the second procedural guarantee given to the accused would be the right to self-defense. Okay, so if you were brought before the court, you had a right to defend yourself. Okay? Again, something we take for granted. But the accused could defend himself, and he could also have a representative speak on his behalf. Okay? He could have someone else, and it was basically this auditor would have the opportunity to speak on the behalf of the accused. The third procedural guarantee was the accused had the right to confront, I'll use the word confront, had the right to confront the witnesses, or at least to hear the testimony that was being given against him. And whatever prosecution there was, whatever charges, whatever evidence came into the court, needed to be based on the testimony of witnesses. And if you know your scriptures, you know that there had to be at least two witnesses to the event in question. All right? And they had to provide details. People, places, things, location, time, stuff like that, so it could be corroborated by other testimony. Okay? Just a short note about testimony in a court. Bearing false witness, if you think about your commandments, you know, that's the words we're talking about here, bearing false witness, lying. Bearing false witness in court, and of course we believe in life as a whole, but bearing false witness was considered a high crime. And it was swiftly punished, and the punishment for false witness in court was that you, the liar, would be punished with the punishment that was supposed to be meted out to the person you were testifying against. So woe unto you if you gave false testimony in a capital crime with the death penalty at stake, because you would be executed. And so there are many different types of crimes, misdemeanors, and so forth. But the principle was very much along the lines of eye for eye, tooth for tooth, to try and keep it fair and even. Okay? Second note in regard to witness, a person could not testify against himself. He could not testify against himself and by that testimony be found guilty. And I thought that was a very interesting one because it reminded me of what? What can you think of in the United States legal system? I plead the Fifth, right? The Fifth Amendment. You have the right not to testify against yourself in a way that incriminates you yourself of wrongdoing. Of course, in our system, as soon as you plead the Fifth, everybody says, oh, he did it. So you better be careful how you use it. But a person could not testify against himself and by that testimony and that testimony alone be found guilty. Okay? The fourth was that the accused had a guarantee of what I'm going to call prescribed execution. And there were certain penalties and ways of dealing with execution that had to be followed. That's what it means. It was all preordained, prescribed, pre-written. In cases of capital punishment, and that's what we're basically talking about here with the trial of Jesus Christ, there was to be a three-day period of waiting. Okay? So let me just walk you through that. There's this hearing, there's this trial, okay? They pass a verdict, if you will. So then there's the remainder of that day, because these trials were supposed to happen during the day. So that night, that day, they had to wait. Then there was an intervening day. So you had the first day. Then there's an intervening day. And the judges were supposed to, and I think this was an ideal scenario, but the judges were supposed to fast. And they were supposed to consider the judgment that they had made, because this was a serious matter. It was a capital case. The death penalty was at stake. So there was to be this intervening day of fasting. Okay? The third day, they would gather together. After reflection, after discussion, they would discuss again the verdicts that they had come to, okay? And they would affirm their verdict. Say, yep, I still did, yep, I feel the same way about it. The idea was that there would not be haste, there would not be emotion. You couldn't have someone whip people up into a frenzy. And some people are very good at that. They're very persuasive and just get people all charged up, and then they march them out and just hang them on a tree. So they had this waiting period, okay? So those are the four things: a right to a public trial, self-defense, to hear and confront the witnesses against him, and a prescribed execution, okay? The overall purpose was to allow every possible opportunity for evidence to come forth that might prove the innocence of the accused. That was their rationale. That was what they were trying to achieve. They didn't want to take a life in vain. Now, again, talking about capital cases here, if that original verdict of death was confirmed on that third day, right, the condemned was then to be swiftly executed on that third day. And another thing about witnesses would be that the accusing witnesses, now if this were in a completely Jewish setting, the witness would be the one to cast the first stone, okay? For those of you who know your scriptures, you know that's a principle from the very beginning. The accuser has to be the one who takes part in the execution. So it all tries to work together so that you take this very seriously and you don't just capriciously condemn people to death. Now let's just take a look at that in Deuteronomy 17, verse 7, okay? You should already be there. Let's read verse 6 and 7. On the testimony of two or three witnesses, a man shall be put to death, but no one shall be put to death on the testimony of only one witness. The hands of the witnesses must be the first in putting him to death, and then the hands of all the people. You must purge the evil from among you. So this is basically saying that the people who testified needed to be part of the execution squad. It also indicates that it needs to be done in public. It's a public execution system. And I find it fascinating that the scriptures here and elsewhere say the hands of all the people need to be on this. Everybody is supposed to participate. All right? I hope they did it in an organized way instead of just a rabble of people casting stones and so forth. But the concept is you all have skin in the game. You know, you're all part of this. Okay? And I think that's something that we don't feel nowadays. We feel very, well, maybe it's just me, but we feel very distant and detached from our legal system. It all just sort of happens out there, and someone's taken off and put in a blue jumpsuit or a green, no, orange jumpsuit. And they just sort of, you never see them again. It takes years sometimes for cases to go through the system in our country. But we're here to talk about what was going on in Jesus' day, so let's focus on that. One last note about execution, and I've mentioned or sort of alluded to this. In that day, they were not in complete control of the legal system or the military or the police or anything like that. So it was the Roman overlords who had the final say in an execution case, okay? So they would not really have the power to, you know, take a person out and throw stones at them to kill them. They had to kind of get the okay from the Romans, all right? But you do see cases like Stephen, for example, where people were publicly executed by the throwing of stones, and I think they picked big stones, you know? So it did happen. I just mention that because, you know, if you know the story, you know that the Romans were the ones who crucified Christ. Okay, so there was a basic court procedure, and I kind of got this from the Simon Greenleaf book, actually the John MacDonald's version of it, which is very interesting. John MacArthur. So the basic court procedure, not very complicated. The accused would be brought before the court, okay? He'd be told of the charges. Makes sense. Next, the witnesses would be brought in. Then they would be kind of like we have swearing in, where the person puts their hand on the Bible and, you know, they pledge to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I don't know what we're going to do about that moving forward, because I don't think people really care whether their hand's on the Bible anymore. But, another sidebar, sorry. So the witnesses in this case, though, they would be warned by the court of their blood guiltiness before God for false testimony. They'd run them through some of the scriptures we read, told them they'd be blood guilty for any testimony that they gave that was false. Okay? Then the testimony against the accused would be heard. Next, the judges would discuss for and against. And after this, the public auditor that I mentioned would be allowed to speak only if he was speaking in defense of the accused. He could not speak if he were adding his 2 cents worth as far as condemning the accused. The accused was then allowed to speak in his own defense if he chose. Then the court would be cleared so the judges could further discuss and render a verdict. Okay? So if acquitted, all right, found not guilty, the accused was discharged immediately. They could walk out of the court. Now, if they were condemned, then this 3-day waiting period that I mentioned or walked you through would kick in. Okay? It sounds to me like a fairly just, fair, equitable system with safeguards protecting the rights of the accused so they couldn't fall into the hands of an angry mob and be swept away and executed just in the passion of the moment. But what about the trial of Jesus? And how was it? If you think about this, and I hope you will, how was it that such a court, this great Sanhedrin, could condemn and put to death, find guilty, Jesus Christ, the only truly innocent person who ever lived? How was it that with all these rules and this knowledge of the Old Testament principles, that this court could find the only pure and innocent person who ever lived and find him guilty? Something had to be going on, and it wasn't good. Well, how'd they do it? By breaking the rules. And basically, they broke all the rules. They broke all the rules. Just as a brief overview, no criminal case was supposed to be conducted in the dead of night, but Jesus was. Judges were to observe an interval of fasting before any execution, that 3-day period, but they killed Jesus Christ the same day, within hours of the verdict. Multiple corroborating witnesses were required, but there were none. The accused had the right of self-defense, but not in this case. Okay? And you'll see that they broke even more, and I'll go through them in a little more detail, okay? So let's take a look at the actual trial. The actual trial in this dark hour. Because it was a dark hour. The hearts of men, the influence of Satan, sounds like all the evil in the world was focused right there at that time, in that city, in that event. And I think at that moment, in that court. So let's take a look at the actual trial. There are 3 phases, if you will, of Jesus' trial. Okay? The first is where Jesus is arrested. He's arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, all right, by the temple and the Roman police. And he's taken before a guy named Ananias. Okay? Then Ananias, after he's done with Jesus, sends Jesus to Caiaphas, who's the high priest, the official high priest. From Caiaphas, Jesus is then taken before the great Sanhedrin for a lickety-split trial where they find him guilty and condemn him to death. Turn with me to John 18. We're not going to look at the arrest. We talked about it a little bit last time I spoke, but we're going to kind of pick it up after that. So Jesus at this point has been arrested. He's been carted off. They tied him up, and they hauled him off to see this guy named Ananias. Okay, so let's just read John 18, verses 12 through 16. Okay. So then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus, and they bound him and brought him first to Annas. And of course, Annas is Ananias. It's written differently in different translations. So I'm going to just go forth calling him Annas. If you're in the King James, you probably see Ananias. I think that's the way it's done. So Ananias was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it would be good if one man died for the people. Now, Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus, so they were kind of following behind this police cohort that had grabbed him and bound him. Because the disciples were known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the girl on duty, and brought Peter in. So right away, we're looking at a sequence of events that's kind of shady. Things aren't really already following proper procedures. First, Jesus was taken to a private home for questioning. He's taken to the home of this guy named Ananias. Who's Ananias? He's the father-in-law of the high priest. Who is he? Why are they taking him to his house? In the dead of night. Okay? Jesus was not taken to any public or official part or place or facility that was part of the legal system. He was taken to a private home for questioning, not a public place, not a place that was part of the legal system. And we can see that it was not publicly accessible, all right? It was not publicly accessible since the two disciples could only get in because they knew one of the servant girls, right? It wasn't open to everybody. The only way they could get in was kind of sneaking through the back door because they knew the maid. So it was in a private home, and it wasn't open to the public, and it was at the dead of night. And things just get worse from there. Okay, so I've asked the question rhetorically, who was this guy Ananias? Well, he was not the high priest, although if you read, you'll see that they referred to him as the high priest. He had been high priest previously, and it was 20 years ago at that time, 20 years past, he'd been the high priest. And he was a very powerful one at that. In fact, he was so powerful that the Romans decided, he can't be high priest anymore. We need someone else because he's just gathering too much power to himself, and we don't like that. So he was removed, and another high priest was put into place. Okay? At this time, of course, and you saw that in the scriptures that we read, it was his son-in-law, Caiaphas, who was the official high priest. He had arranged for other family members to be the high priest. Okay, it was somewhat hereditary, but the way they actually did it was he had all kinds of different family members. So you can kind of see Ananias in the background, kind of like the puppet master. I think of him as the godfather behind the whole thing. And he's got this whole operation going on, and he keeps things under his thumb, and he's got all these guys, and they do his bidding. But he's the real brains of the organization. You know what I mean? You know what I'm talking about? So this is how I see Ananias. And I mentioned 20 years earlier, he'd been removed from office because he was getting too powerful. But he's obviously still very powerful. Because he's the first guy that they take Jesus to see. Right? He's got a nice big house with a big courtyard. The average person didn't have that. This guy was wealthy and powerful. Ananias. So what sort of power might a high priest have? Okay? And I'm gonna suppose a few things here. All right? I'm going to try and connect some dots. But, it's kind of my observation on it. What kind of power might the high priest have? Well, one of the things that was going on in Jerusalem, and one of the things that the high priests had a lot of control over, was the temple environment. And there was a lot of money that flowed through the temple. People were bringing sacrifices to the temple all the time. Well, what do you know about a sacrifice? It had to be what? Perfect. Who judged whether it was perfect or not? The priests. So people brought in animals, okay? The priest, who just happened to have a sideline of selling perfect animals, would take a look at this animal, all right? And he'd say, I'm sorry, this is just not perfect. It's not suitable for sacrifice. I do happen to have a nice selection of merchandise here. Some pigeons, some lambs. All right? You see how it might work? So these people come in from Galilee. They've come a long way. I wouldn't be surprised if it just reached the point where people didn't even bother anymore. Why bring it? Why bring this goat in? Because it's, you know, just some guy is going to tell you that it's not perfect. Then he's going to sell you a goat. And the problem was, well, they built in a respectable profit margin to these goats and sheep. It wasn't a public service. It was profitable. It was profitable. Okay? Donations. People made donations to the temple. They could only make it with temple currency. Okay? When Jesus came into the temple, what did he do? He started ripping the place up because it was full of pens of goats and tables where people were changing money. And they were ripping people off. They could only pay their temple tax or make their donations in temple dollars. And the money changers had a nice profit going on. They had a nice operation. And this Jesus guy is messing it up. He's bad for business. I'm being a little silly, but I mean, really, when you got a racket, you got a racket. Whether you're a mafioso or a high priest, a racket's a racket. And I think there was a racket going on. And they didn't like Jesus criticizing them, making them look bad, pointing out the irregularities in what they were doing and the obvious injustice of what they were doing. It was bad for business, whatever accent you want to use. So Ananias, as I mentioned, was obviously he was a big wheel. You know, kind of the brains behind the operation, if you will, maintaining control from behind the scenes by getting a succession of family members and in-laws chosen as the high priest while he remained powerful, kind of the power behind the curtain. Now, like I said, there's a lot of supposing in there for me, but consider it. Read the scriptures and think about it. Why would Jesus be so mad at them for what they were doing? So whatever was really going on, Annas, he was the first one they took Jesus to see. He wanted to see this guy. He wanted to talk to him. Okay? Even though it doesn't appear that Annas had any official or legal status as a court member, he might have, but it's not indicated. Was he supposed to be part of this process? Well, it wasn't part of the official process at all. Bringing Jesus before Annas was completely outside the legal structure. It was something, you know, kind of really bending the rules. You know, at this point, and you see this, we'll read these verses. At this point, there was no real official charge. They had never charged him with anything. They had not charged Jesus with any crime. They just arrested him. A person brought to trial, a person who's going to be questioned, if you will, has a right to know what he's being charged with. I mean, you see that, you know, you watch Law and Order and these shows. Well, what am I even being charged with? You don't have any charges against my client. He's going to go, right? That's how we do it. Well, it's kind of the same thing there. He wasn't accused of any crime. There were no witnesses. There was no evidence. But they bring him in, and they want to talk to him. And this guy, Annas, wants to talk to him. Let's just read verse 19. Meanwhile, the high priest, this is Annas, so they're referring to him as the high priest here, even though Caiaphas is the high priest. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Okay? So, what is Annas doing here? He appears to be fishing. He's looking for something. So, what have you been up to? What are you doing? He just, you know, the guy's been arrested. You don't have any charges. You don't have any evidence. You bring him in and say, so tell me about yourself. Why? He's fishing around for something because he's got nothing. At this point, he's got nothing. He's looking for something he can pin on him. We need to pin something on this guy so we can get him. He's fishing around, okay? Looking for something that he can accuse Jesus of. Now, Annas, I assume, Caiaphas definitely, and the rest, they'd already decided on the sentence that they wanted to have, okay? Let's see, verse 14 refers to a longer section of scripture, and I'll let you read that on your own, but in verse 14 we read, Caiaphas, the high priest, was the one who advised the Jews that it would be good for one man to die for the people. So they already had the sentence figured out. He's going to die. We need to execute this guy. Now all we need to do is find a crime. We need to find something to pin on this guy. Does that sound like a fair and equitable legal procedure? No. Go back and you listen and just read what Caiaphas says. They'd already made up their mind what they wanted to do. Now all they needed was a crime to match, and they wanted something with the death penalty on it. If they had actually had a case, if there actually had been a crime, all they would need to do would be just take him to court, present the witnesses, and proceed with the case. But that's not how they did it. The first thing they did was they took him to this guy, Annas, to fish around. Let's see what we can find on this guy. All right, let's read verses 20 and 21. Jesus replies to Annas and says, I've spoken openly to the world, Jesus replied. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. So what is Jesus doing here? He's, in a way, pointing out, what are you doing? This, you don't have any case against me. You don't have any crime. You don't have any witnesses. Go find some witnesses. I spoke every day openly in the temple, in the synagogues. Why are we here? Why are we here? What crime are you accusing me of? What witnesses do you have? Of course, the answer is none. Verse 22. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest? He demanded. So, you know, Jesus says, what about my legal rights? And they whack him on the head, basically. Is that any way to talk to the boss? Because he wasn't the high priest. He was the father-in-law of the high priest. Okay? Very shady. Very irregular. What does Jesus do? Verse 23. They just whacked him on the head. And just remember, and again, who Jesus was. God in the flesh. So how does he respond? Does he call down fire? Legions of angels? No. He says to them, if I have said something wrong, testify as to what is wrong. But I spoke the truth. So why did you strike me? Then Ananias sent him, still bound, to Caiaphas, the high priest. So Jesus, he doesn't retaliate. He doesn't curse or strike back. Instead, he refers them back to the legality of the situation, or the illegality of the situation, that they're violating the most basic precepts of justice and fairness. I think this is important because God is nothing if not just and fair. If he's not just and fair, then we've got to rethink the whole thing. But he is. Now, in verse 24, of course, Annas decides that he can't find anything on this guy. It's fruitless. He's probably frustrated. So he sends him on to the high priest, his son-in-law, Caiaphas. Now, John does not record the rest of the trial and its, you know, proceedings before the Sanhedrin. But Matthew does. So we're going to go to Matthew. Let's go to Matthew 26, okay? Matthew 26, verses 59 through 62. Matthew 26, verses 59 through 62. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? Okay. I guess I should have read verse 57, just to link the two scriptures together, where we're told that those who had arrested Jesus then took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, okay, where the teachers of the law and the elders were all assembled, okay? So they're all gathered together. The Sanhedrin guys are kind of getting together here, gathered together. They want to get their story straight. I just want to take a moment to read the parallel account in Mark 14. Mark 14, because this bears on the calling of witnesses. Mark 14, verses 56 through 60. Okay, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any, and many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this man-made temple in 3 days, and I will build another, not made by man. Yet even their testimony did not agree. If you compare the testimony you just heard in Mark to the what we read previously in Matthew, those are two different statements. They don't agree. In fact, what Jesus actually said was, if you destroy this temple, I will raise it up. He didn't talk about destroying the temple himself. And you can read that in John 2, verse 19. Okay, so going back to Matthew, because we'll just follow Matthew's account for the most part. It's more complete. Excuse me, it's more complete. The high priest says, okay, so these guys, they're coming, they're saying this stuff about you. What have you got to say in your defense? What does Jesus say? What does Jesus say? Let me find it. Okay, verse 63. But Jesus remained silent. He didn't say anything. Okay? Why? Because there was nothing to say. Because it wasn't true. Jesus, I think, and but you know what we know of him, I think he, when he didn't have anything to say, he didn't say anything. He only talked when it was important and necessary. Jesus remains silent. He has no need to say anything because there's nothing yet to defend himself against. Okay? There's still no charge. There's still no crime. All right? Now, if these worthless witnesses had brought forth a charge that they really, you know, could agree on, a charge that made any sense, then they would have had a case against him and they would have just rolled forward with it. But you'll see, they don't. They don't do anything with this testimony because it's going all over the place. These guys can't agree on the time, the date, the people, who said what they say, what they mean. None of it. It doesn't agree. So their testimony is worthless. They don't move on this testimony. Okay? But like many people in this life, the court had already made up its mind. They'd already made up their mind what they were going to do. They'd already made up their mind what they wanted to believe about Jesus. Based on what? Well, they weren't looking for truth. They were just looking for a solution. They weren't looking for the truth. This was not a court that was investigating and trying to find the truth, what really happened. They just wanted to kill him because he didn't fit into their plans. They didn't like the way he messed things up for them. And I think that's a parallel that you see in lives every day. People, a lot of people, just they've already made up their mind about what they're going to believe and what they are willing to believe. And they're not really looking for truth. My opinion, if people were really looking for proof, they'd do more investigation. They'd want to find out what really happened, right? But most people, they're not looking for proof. They're not looking for anything except arguments they can use to prop up what they already believe, to support what they've already decided. Sad to say, but at least from what I can see, the average person is not terribly interested in carefully investigating and weighing the truth about God. Other factors have already made the decision for them, like pride, their position, how much they've got to lose, hurt feelings, love of money, sensual pleasure. Based on these things, they've already decided what they believe, what they're willing to believe. They've already declared a verdict without really considering the alternative, which is, well, what if? What if he really is who he says he is? What if it's really true? Well, that would mean, no, I don't want to go there. I can't allow myself to believe that, so I won't accept it. I don't want to hear anymore. I don't want anyone to save me. I don't want a Messiah. I'm not going to accept any judgment. I'll be the judge. And I've already decided what I'm going to believe. The great Sanhedrin, they'd already decided their verdict, right? They just needed to find some shred of evidence that they could use against Jesus to get him convicted and sentenced and executed. Now, dawn was approaching, so the time was coming when they could have their trial, but they needed to move quickly. They needed to do this trial in daytime to keep it official. They wanted to get it done before the people awoke and they might lose the opportunity because Jesus was very popular with the crowds. All right? Plus, ironically, sadly, and in some ways kind of gross, they needed to have enough time to wash the blood off their hands before they went and kept God's holy day. Right? That's what the scriptures say they wanted to do. Matthew 26, let's look at verse 62. Okay, so the high priest stood up and he said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent, okay? They were just waiting for something they could pounce on, but he said nothing. There were no charges, no crime. Verse 63, the high priest then said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." So the high priest, he calls forth this sacred oath before the living God, and he asks Jesus point blank to admit that he was the Messiah and the living God in the flesh. Okay? Now, from his perspective, he's thinking, all right, I'm going to get this guy. I'm going to put him in a box canyon. I'm going to trap him. He's thinking that by getting Jesus to speak these words, he would be able to catch him on a charge of blasphemy. Okay? Which was punishable by death. You can take a look at Leviticus 24, verse 16, for example. Okay? Blasphemy, punishable by death. I think I've got it now. This is something we could pin on this guy. Jesus, well, as he mentioned earlier, he had spoken publicly and fairly plainly in public places to large groups of people, sometimes as much as 10,000 people at a time. He had always spoke openly about the fact that he was the prophesied Messiah. He never denied it. Let's put it that way. He never denied that he was the Messiah. All right? For example, take a look at Luke 4, verse 21, John 4, verse 25 and 26, Matthew 21, verse 9. Okay? However, he also didn't walk into town waving his hands around saying, "Hey, hey, I'm the Messiah." He didn't, because that was not part of the plan. He didn't make a big deal about himself being the Messiah, because that kind of would have messed things up. In fact, he actually asked the disciples not to talk about it with anyone when they had the discussion in Matthew 16. About who do people say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Well, you're the Messiah. Yes, you're right. But let's just not talk about that, make a big deal out of it. This is basically what he tells the disciples, okay? Now, likewise, Jesus had also openly presented himself as one with the Father and the Son of Man who would come in righteousness on the clouds at the right hand of God. You take a look at John 10, verse 30, again, Matthew 16. But let's get back to the story or the narrative at hand here, okay? Verse 64. So, Jesus, what's he going to do? He's got this challenge. I challenge you, I charge you before the living God to tell us, are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God? Well, as he had in the past, Jesus does not deny it. He takes the oath and he affirms that fact. Let's read it. He says, yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied, but I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming in the clouds of heaven. So he takes the oath. He affirms, yes, I am just as you had said. And then he does something very interesting. Okay, he's quoting there from Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14. And he says, okay, yeah, I'm who you said. I'm the Messiah, Son of God, in the flesh. And you're going to see me again. No matter what goes down here, I'm adding a bit. Of course, I'm kind of embellishing a little bit. But he's basically saying, you're going to see me again. And you'll recognize that I am the judge. I am the judge. And I'll be sitting at the right hand of the Father. Now, I don't consider Jesus' words to Caiaphas to be some sort of threat. You know, like he's saying, and then you're going to get yours, buddy. I don't see it that way. You just wait. It'll come down on you. No, I don't think that's the way Jesus is. I don't think that's the way he was speaking to Caiaphas. I don't take it as a threat of vengeance, although God says vengeance is mine. Why is vengeance God's? Because he's the only one you can trust. He's the only one you can trust to take vengeance without passion, anger, to overstep his bounds, to act unjustly. Right? Don't leave vengeance to me. I'm not going to be the one you want. You want God, because he's the only one who's going to give you a fair shake. That's the way I interpret what Jesus is saying here. Because I know that with God there is no shadow of turning. There's no special treatment, or either for good or for evil. With God, even Caiaphas is going to get a judgment that is fair, just, and compassionate. Whatever he decides about Caiaphas, and it's none of my business really, it will be based on truth, not wishes. And in God's love, I have complete confidence that it will be the best possible verdict for either an eternal future for Caiaphas or any of us, or an eternal non-future. Let's read verse 65 and 66. So then the high priest tore his clothes, and that was a kind of a traditional symbol of outrage. You tear the sleeve off his robe or something like that, or just, he might have had like a little Velcro strap he'd use if he wanted to do it a lot. But he tore his garments, okay? And he says, he has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you guys think? He is worthy of death, they answered. Now, in the eyes of the great Sanhedrin, Jesus had just condemned himself by his own words, okay? But if you remember that one of the principles of court procedure, this testimony would not be admissible and sufficient to condemn Jesus, okay? Because the accused could not incriminate himself, right? Now, you could say, oh, well, they themselves were the witnesses, okay? By hearing this blasphemy, they could become the witnesses. But does it really sound right that the court could be the impartial judge? They could take on the role of the prosecutor and be the witnesses? Does that sound right to you? They called it blasphemy, okay? And they sentenced him to death. They didn't take the time to deliberate and talk about it, think about it. They just said, yes, you got him. He's ours now. We sentence him to death. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to be too theatrical about it, but I think they were glad. I think they achieved what they wanted. So they called it blasphemy and they sentenced him to death. But they actually ended up sentencing him to death and subsequently having him executed because he told the truth. And that's what Jesus was crucified for. That's how he was executed. He was executed for telling the truth, because that's the charge that they had against him. Blasphemy. Right? That's the only charge they could come up with. They asked him, they told him, we're going to do this oath before the living God. You tell us, are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God? And he says, yes. Yeah, we got you. So they end up killing him because he tells them the truth. The truth is a funny thing. Funny thing. Have you ever asked yourself, why am I here? Why do I keep coming back? You know, year after year after year, as the years go by. And I ask myself sometimes, you know, why am I still here? Why am I here today in this room with these people on this day? Well, I'm going to tell you something that's a little bit personal, and you all have your own reasons. I'm not here because you guys are the warmest, friendliest people on the planet. Although you are warm and friendly, and I like that. I'm not here for the social activities, although I do appreciate the social activities. I didn't begin worshiping together with the people of God so I could meet girls or find a wife. I'm not here to be part of a world-class organization. I'm not here to listen to uplifting music. I'm not here to be entertained. I'm not here for wit or charm. I'm here for the truth. That's why I'm here. That's why I keep coming back. Because I want the truth. And sometimes the truth hurts. And I'm talking personally. I'm not talking about you. Sometimes the truth hurts. It's painful. When I really know the truth. You know, when Jesus told people about, you know, you have to eat of my flesh and drink of my blood. And a lot of people said, this guy's wacky. I'm getting out of here. And they started leaving him. He turned to the disciples and he said, so are you guys going to leave too? What did they say? Peter said, you have the words of life. I think I'll add truth. Where else am I going to go? Hard as it is, where else do I have to go? Unless I reach a point where I don't care about truth anymore. Now, Jesus' judges, they didn't want to know the truth. Okay? I think that's fairly plain reading through the scriptural account. They didn't want to know the truth. Okay? They knew it was public knowledge that he had performed miracles. They knew that he'd raised Lazarus. Go and read that account and you'll see that that is the signature event. When he raised Lazarus, they said, okay, that's it. This guy's got to die. That was the moment when Caiaphas said, okay, this guy has got to die or else we're all going down. They knew that 1,000 armed men sent to arrest him had fallen down on the ground at the power of him speaking his name to them and telling them who he really was. I am. They knew that he had reached out and taken the ear that was sliced off the guy's head, Malchus, and just put it back on in a show of great compassion. They also knew they could find no credible witnesses against him of any sin. They tried. They really tried. But they wanted him gone and they wanted him out of their lives. And the only way to get him out of your life is to reject the truth. Now, people turn away from God every day. It happens. People turn away from God every day because they don't want to face the truth. They don't want to honestly examine and evaluate what God has presented them with. Somewhat my opinion, I suppose. But I think a lot of people, let's just not say everybody, but a lot of people just don't want to examine the truth. Do you reject God because you have thoroughly investigated and you have really, with an open mind and an open heart, thought about what's really involved and the life issues at stake? Have you really, really done your homework before you make your decision and your verdict? Do people really want to honestly examine what God has presented them with in His Word, in His way of living, His creation, the testimony and witnesses of the patriarchs, the prophets, the eyewitnesses of Jesus' life and teaching? Nah, I don't want to hear it, because my parents spanked me too much. I just, like, blocked it all out. Nah. You know, I don't like the minister, so I'm not listening anymore. I already made up my mind. Well, my good-looking biology teacher, he's an atheist, and he's pretty cool. So, yeah, I made up my mind. Yeah, I'm good. Well, I don't want to be teased. I just want to be left alone. I want to be normal. I want to fit in, have a regular life. So, you know, made up my mind. I'm good. I'm good. I'm done. Don't worry. I'm cool. I'm fine. We don't really want to examine our lives, because the truth hurts. The truth hurts. At least it hurts for me. I don't know. Maybe you've got some special recipe, but I find the truth really hurts. The truth hurts when you examine your own life, and allow yourself to be subject to examination from the Word of God and comparing yourself to the standard of Jesus Christ. I mean, and I'm talking about, when I talk about examining yourself, I'm talking about truthful examination. Not the self-congratulating foolishness that passes for self-awareness these days. You know, I looked inside and all I really needed to find was that I'm actually a really good person. And I feel so much better about myself since then. That's not what we're talking about. But that's what people do nowadays. Yeah, reach deep within and find that you're really good. Go with it. I'm sorry, that's just the world we live in, folks. It's a crazy place. You hear crazy stuff every day at school, on TV, at work. It's a nut house out there. Don't drink it. Don't swallow it down, because it's not the way of truth and it is not the way to life. The truth may change our lives, and that's why it's painful. It has the potential to turn lifestyles upside down and expose me for what I really am. And that can be painful. As the saying goes, the truth hurts. The men of the great Sanhedrin, well, they didn't want to hear the truth, right? They had different reasons. It was more political than personal. They didn't want to hear the truth. And if you think about it, they would rather choose death and stay blind than face the truth and say to themselves, maybe I should look into what this guy's saying. Based on all that I've seen and heard, maybe I should actually think about this and weigh the evidence and make an informed verdict. Let's read verses 66 and 67 again. What do you think, guys? He's worthy of death, they answered. And then the great wise men of the Sanhedrin spit in his face. They spit in his face, they smacked him, and they pounded him with their fists. Other people then slapped him, and they said, prophesy to us, Christ. Who hit you? People don't just reject God. They end up mocking God and hating God. And that's a bad place to be. Let's continue reading. Let's drop down to Matthew 27. I'd just like to read Matthew 27, verses 1 and 2. Because this is where the trial ends. That's where we'll end today. Matthew 27, verses 1 and 2. So early in the morning, as the sun came up, now was their chance to have an official legal trial in daylight, but conveniently before most people were up and about, at dawn, early in the morning, All the chief priests and the elders of the people came to the decision to put Jesus to death. They bound him and led him away and handed him over to Pilate, the governor. And when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 silver coins to the chief priests and the elders, and he said, "I have sinned, for I have betrayed innocent blood." And that's what Jesus' blood was, innocent blood. But the time to change, the time to have a change of heart and a change of mind is before you reject him, before you cause this great evil. So they did this, they did the deal. The sun came up, they made it fast, they sentenced him to death, and they handed him over to Pilate, the governor, and then he was executed. And that is the trial of Jesus Christ before the Sanhedrin, the great legal body of Israel informed by the scriptures. And I'll leave it up to you. Is it a fair verdict or not? Was he given justice or not? If God himself can face injustice in this world, hopefully so can we. I mean, his example in so many ways is inspiring to us. And, you know, you can look around at the world and say, it's just not just. And some people do that. They look at the world and say, well, it's not just and it's not fair. So I reject God. I reject everything. But he was willing to put up with injustice for the truth, for the sake of truth, and stay with it and set a great example for us, something we can remember through this Passover season, the incredible indignities that he was willing to suffer for our sake.